Hello and welcome to Seeing Red. I'm Mark.
And I'm Bethan, and thank you for joining us for our Season 3 finale. Don't worry, we are only taking a week off and we will be back with Season 4 on the 20th of May.
We would like to say a huge thank you to all of our Patreon supporters before we go any further. The support we have received on Patreon has been phenomenal this season. So many of you have climbed on board and we are so grateful. You have made the difference and have ensured that we'll be back for Season 4, so thank you, and we would especially like to thank our most recent supporters.
So thank you to Lauren Brown, Steve Collins and Becky Mackey.
So this week we head north to the ominously named Black Isle, a peninsula in the Scottish Islands. Home to a population of 12,000, the Black Isle is a beautiful corner of the world. Bottlenose dolphins can be seen from the beach at Channery Point, and the area is known for its numerous castles, one of which was visited by Mary Queen of Scots. Steeped in history, the area has advanced somewhat in recent years with the opening of the Keswick Bridge in 1982, which links a Black Isle with the city of Inverness. Since the introduction of the bridge, the Black Isle has become something of a commuter zone, resulting in swathes of city folk moving out of Inverness and into the small towns and villages dotted around the Black Isle. This once collection of small, tight-knit communities is now slightly more anonymous. However, many of the towns and villages are still dominated by a small number of families, with three or four generations often living within a few hundred metres of each other. This is still the sort of place where the locals would stop and stare if you walked into a pub and were not from round these parts. Coolbokey, a small village on the Black Isle, approximately 9 miles north of Inverness, was home to the Sutherland family in 1984. Elizabeth, or Totsy as she was called, was mum to 12-year-old son Stephen and 9-year-old daughter Jane. Totsy's husband Kenny was a builder and had built the bungalow in which the family lived. It was a short walk from Totsy's parents, Donald and Margaret, and her sister Jane. They were a close, extended family. While Totsy's husband Kenny was quiet and reserved, preferring to keep himself to himself, Totsy was more outgoing and revelled in village life. She was small in stature, just 4'9", but her enthusiasm for life made her presence known. Village stalwart Alice MacDonald, who ran the local shop and had known Totsy since she was a young child, described her by saying she was jolly, always very busy and involved in things like the WI and flower arranging. The summer of 1984 was long and delicious on the Black Isle. The maritime influence and relatively low altitude give the area a milder climate compared to the drama of the neighbouring West Highlands. The Sutherland family had enjoyed long sunny days on the beach that summer, but with the days starting to get shorter and the skies filling with grey cloud as October loomed, any hope of an Indian summer was dashed. Lazy days in the sunshine were now a distant memory, and as the family returned to a more normal existence of school, work and household chores, an even darker cloud was looming on the horizon. A cloud that would linger over the Sutherland family and the Black Isle for the rest of time. Monday the 24th of September saw the dawn of a new week in the Sutherland household. It started out like any other Monday that month. Totsy waved off Stephen as he boarded the school bus and kissed Kenny goodbye as he headed off to a building job 10 miles away. Daughter Jane still attended the village primary school, so Totsy dropped her off there before collecting the newspaper from the local shop and then heading home to get on with the washing. Monday was always wash day in the Sutherland house, and the weather that day wasn't too bad for the time of year. Totsy knew she would be able to get all of the washing done and dried before the children got home. After a couple of hours of washing, Totsy headed to her parents' house to see her sister. The pair would often meet mid-morning for a coffee and a chat, and this day was no exception. She and her sister loved gardening, and they discussed the bulbs they were going to enter in a local competition. They had done well the year before and were keen to repeat that success. Totsy walked the 50 yards home shortly after midday, but was back a few minutes later when she realised she'd forgotten the instructions for planting the bulbs. After another brief chat, she set off for home again. It was 12:40 p.m. and the last time her sister would see her alive. When 9-year-old Jane arrived home later that day, she called out for her mother. Totsie was usually to be found in the kitchen at this time, but right now there was no sign of her. Jane went into each room of the house looking for her mother, but she wasn't there. Perhaps she had popped out and would be back in a few minutes. Although unusual, Jane wasn't overly concerned and headed for her bedroom to get changed out of her school clothes. When Jane entered the room, what she saw would stay with her for the rest of her life. Her beloved mother was lying face down on the floor in a pool of blood, having been stabbed several times in the chest and neck.
Christ, a 9-year-old having to find that. Oh my God.
Absolutely terrible, isn't it?
Oh, bless her.
So, in shock, Jane managed to call the police, who arrived at the house shortly after 4 p.m. Stephen arrived home from school to a house that was surrounded by police. The devastating news that his mother had passed away was broken to him, and Kenny, Totsie's husband, was contacted and told to return home immediately. In the blink of an eye, this tight family unit had been shattered into 1,000 pieces. As forensic experts combed the scene for clues, Kenny, Stephen and Jane went to stay with Totsie's parents, who were equally heartbroken. Jane had been at the house just hours earlier. How was it possible that she was now dead? As the family attempted to come to terms with their loss in the days that followed, the police launched an investigation and began house-to-house inquiries. Everyone in the village, which had a population of just 300, had their own theory about what had happened to Totsie. Some secretly suspected neighbours or even relatives. Others pointed the finger at Totsie's husband, Kenny. He was a quiet man, someone who was able to keep his emotions in check. And to some, this appeared cold, given the circumstances.
Can you imagine as well, there's only 300 of you living in the village, so you're going to be like suspecting people who you're really close to. That must have been just absolutely mad to kind of think, I wonder if it was this next door neighbour or this person I see at the shops.
Yeah, you would have known everybody in that village, I think, pretty much. The police did question Kenny in the early stages of their investigation, but they quickly discounted him as a suspect. He had an alibi for the time of the murder, and besides, what would his motive have been? Detectives were satisfied there was no financial gain to be made from Totsie's death. There were no secret lovers on either side. They appeared to be a happily married couple. Detective Superintendent Andy Lister headed up the inquiry and quickly established that Totsie's time of death was close to 1 p.m. Forensics had discovered the murder weapon by now, a large kitchen knife which had been washed and put back in a drawer, but which still carried traces of Totsie's blood.
That's really quite, like, mad, isn't it, that it was washed back up and put back in the drawer? That's a lot of, like, time to think about stuff after you've killed her. Wow.
It is, isn't it? It's almost an instinctive thing to do, though, which we will come on to later, because I think there's an interesting element here. But also, it saved the murderer having to take the weapon with them.
But I think, generally, would you not just drop and run, perhaps, if you're in a situation where you've just stabbed someone? I don't know, like, it seems strange to me that you'd have the thoughts to actually go and clean it up.
But maybe it had his fingerprints on.
Yeah, true, actually.
And washing it would get rid of the fingerprints as well as the blood. 4 indistinguishable footprints were found in the vegetable patch, and a fingerprint was found in the house which could not be attributed to anybody the family knew. What's more, all of the curtains had been closed in the house, a common practice among burglars, but nothing had been taken. Had Totsie disturbed the intruder when she had returned home from meeting her sister, perhaps? So, despite this evidence, detectives struggled to identify any suspects, and consequently they turned to the media, where they appealed for information from the local community. There was a distinct belief that the murderer was a local man, someone living within the community, someone who knew Totsie and the surrounding area. In the weeks that followed, villagers started to lock their doors whenever they left the house. There was an air of mistrust hanging over the village, and people lived in fear. A killer was on the loose, and for all they knew, he lived next door to them, slept in the bed next to them, taught their children at the primary school, or even served them in the local shop.
Yeah, I think that's what really, really freaks me out with this.
Yeah, I think it's a super interesting case because it's such a small community and it really was a case of people pointing the finger of suspicion at each other. I think it would have made for a great kind of drama, like a Broadchurch or something.
Yeah, I think so.
So in order to alleviate the fears of villagers, Detective Superintendent Andy Lister stationed an officer at the village hall. PC Don McLeod based himself there on a permanent basis. He knew many people in the village and drank at the local pub, the Kolboki Inn. D.S. Lister knew locals would be more willing to share their suspicions with someone they knew, someone they trusted. But the tactic yielded no credible leads. And with suspicion in the village now rife, D.S. Lister announced the existence of the unexplained fingerprints found at the scene. He invited all males aged between 16 and 65 to present themselves for fingerprinting at the village hall, but none proved to be a match. As the weeks turned into months, Kenny moved back into the family home with his children. 4 months after Totsie's death, the police turned to the BBC programme Crime Watch for help. A reconstruction was broadcast, followed by an appeal for information. The reconstruction featured information that had not previously been released to the public for operational reasons. A lorry driver recalled being overtaken by an impatient driver in a red car near to Totsie's house. Sometime later, he saw the car again parked less than a quarter of a mile away, but the driver this time was nowhere to be seen. Other suspicious sightings were detailed from the day of Totsie's murder, including a cyclist who police hadn't been able to trace, a man walking near to Totsie's house, and a white Cavalier parked up close to the house. D.S. Lister also appealed for information pertaining to a man seen walking into a petrol station near to Kolboki at 9:30 p.m. on the evening of the murder. The man was carrying a petrol canister and spoke in an English accent as he asked the attendant for 20 Regal cigarettes. Although he didn't disclose it to the viewers at the time, D.S. Lister was particularly keen to hear from anyone who had seen this man, as the garage attendant had noticed blood on his right hand. The attendant also remembered the man was travelling south. Although 100 calls were received following the appeal, no credible lines of inquiry presented themselves.
This case reminds me a little bit of the Beast of Jersey, the guy that went around attacking and raping people in Jersey, like this whole small village, and it just really, really freaks me out. And the fact that they asked everybody to come forward and give their fingerprints, but they couldn't find anybody, oh, I don't like it. It's really, really freaks me out.
But if you think as well with that fingerprint, it's one fingerprint that's unidentified in the house. It may not have been the killer.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But I don't know, like this case is really horrible.
Yeah, it's quite a weird kind of moody sort of case, I think, because of the setting and also the really small community in which it happened, for sure. So I think we'll pause there and have a word from another of today's sponsors. In August 1985, there was a burglary in Kolboki. One line of inquiry the police had been pursuing in relation to Totsie's death was that it was a burglary that had gone wrong. The house involved in this latest burglary was a bungalow, just like Totsie's house had been, and it backed onto a forest, as did Totsie's. Chief Inspector Johnny Johnson, D.S. Lister's deputy, remarked sometime later, saying, "Thieves are creatures of habit, so we were keen to talk to whoever was responsible for this." Around this time, police took a call from a garage hand in Mur of Ord, a town just off the Black Isle. A man he vaguely knew had come into the garage and asked him to drill holes in some new car number plates. And he was suspicious. He had made a note of the real registration number for the vehicle the man had been driving. When police ran this through the DVLA database, they found the car had been reported missing from Perth, and so a warrant was issued for the man's arrest.
That's so good of the guy from the garage to think to do that.
Yeah, because this really was the breakthrough. Without him coming forward with those suspicions, they wouldn't have got anywhere, really. So the man in question was 30-year-old George McPhee, who lived just south of the Scottish border in County Durham. George McPhee was tall and athletic with dark hair. He had been brought up in Tor on the Black Isle, just over the hill from Kolboki. As a child, he would often go rabbiting in the forests nearby, and so despite now living in County Durham, he was very familiar with the area. McPhee was promptly found and brought in for questioning. His home was searched, where officers found a television which had come from the recent burglary in Kolboki, but there was nothing to connect McPhee to Tots's murder. Detectives soon realised they'd already spoken to McPhee in connection with Tots's murder. He was questioned, along with hundreds of other men, around a month into their inquiry. However, he seemed to have an alibi. McPhee claimed that at the time of the murder, he'd been travelling down to England with a friend named Colin Hawkins. When police questioned Hawkins, he admitted the pair had committed a series of burglaries around the time of Tots's murder. The pair were charged with theft and police put pressure on Hawkins, making him believe he was a suspect in Tots's murder. Eventually, worried he would go down for this, he made a statement naming George McPhee for the murder. Hawkins told officers the pair were driving around Kolboki in a red van on the morning of the 24th of September when they spotted Tots's bungalow. With a forest to the rear providing concealed access and a quick getaway, and no neighbours within 50 yards, they decided it was the perfect target. And so they drove into the forest at the back of the bungalow, where, according to Hawkins, they agreed that McPhee would commit the burglary whilst Hawkins kept watch. Hawkins said he expected McPhee to only take a few minutes, but after half an hour and no sign of him, he grew concerned. When McPhee finally returned to the van, he was suspiciously free of swag. What's more, he had washed his hands, which had been noticeably dirty prior to the burglary.
I want to know more about how quickly this guy was willing to just turn on his friend, or were they even friends? Like, this is all of a sudden, it feels like.
Yeah, they were friends, but I think that Hawkins found out that McPhee had committed an indecent assault on a girl, and that kind of totally obviously went against his own values, and he kind of ended the friendship, I think, then, which must have been after this whole event, I don't know.
Yeah.
So they had fallen out, essentially, but I think that the biggest factor was the fact the police were putting a lot of pressure on Hawkins, and they were saying, look, basically, if you don't say that it was McPhee, we're going to charge you with her murder.
God, that's so crazy.
Yeah. So after the burglary, the pair hid for a few hours in a nearby quarry before driving back to County Durham under the cover of darkness. Hawkins recalled how they had stopped at a petrol station a few miles outside of Kolboki at approximately 9:30 p.m. as they'd run out of petrol. Hawkins said he bought the petrol and 20 Regal cigarettes for McPhee, while McPhee darted into a pub over the road for a quick drink. When Chief Inspector John Johnson asked him about the blood on his hand, he claimed he'd cut himself with a hacksaw earlier as he and McPhee sawed down snow poles which they were stealing for scrap.
And what, the police just didn't really think that potentially he was the murderer then?
No, they weren't having that at all.
Wow.
McPhee was promptly charged with Tots's murder and remanded in custody whilst he awaited his trial, which began on the 26th of November in 1985 at Inverness High Court. McPhee pleaded not guilty and Hawkins gave evidence against him. Hawkins claimed McPhee had looked shocked upon returning to the van following the break-in at Tots's. When pressed by the prosecution counsel, Alistair Dunlop, to elaborate, he said, "Well, he looked just like my mother did the day my sister died." The packed court also heard from convicted drug dealer Trevor Proudfoot, who had spent time in prison with McPhee as he awaited trial. He testified that McPhee had confessed the murder to him. When he was notified that his alibi was to be called into question, McPhee withdrew it and said he was there on the day of the murder, but he was the one who had waited in the van acting as lookout whilst Hawkins had gone into the house to commit the burglary. Jurors were now convinced it was either Hawkins or McPhee. One of them had committed this heinous crime, and the prosecution's case pointed the finger firmly at McPhee. The pathologist testified that, in his view, based on the injuries Totsie sustained, the murderer was tall and well built. McPhee was over 6 foot and weighed 13.5 stone. Hawkins was 5'9" and slight. Further damning evidence pointed to McPhee. The footprints found in the vegetable patch had come from a size 9 or 10 shoe. McPhee was a size 9. Hawkins was a size 7.
Okay, so that kind of would make me think, okay, potentially.
Definitely. Of course it does.
Mm.
After a 7-day trial, the jury of 8 women and 7 men retired to consider their verdict. The following morning, they found George McPhee guilty of Totsie's murder, and the judge sentenced him to life imprisonment with a recommendation that he should serve at least 25 years. The judge described the murder as callous and brutal in nature, and the Sutherland family, husband Kenny, daughter Jane and son Stephen, felt a sense of closure as justice was served. Or was it? What followed proved to be one of the worst miscarriages of justice in UK criminal history. George McPhee was innocent and Totsie's killer is still at large some 34 years later.
Jesus, I know we like a miscarriage of justice case on this show, but that's horrific.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, bless.
McPhee had always strenuously denied he was in any way responsible for Totsie's murder. His wife Pauline and his 2 sons, George and Andrew, never wavered in their support for him. George McPhee spent 18 years in jail for a crime he did not commit. Initially freed in 2003, pending an appeal of his conviction, he was ultimately declared innocent 18 months later, when in 2005 his conviction was quashed following significant question marks over the evidence that was presented at his trial. So what happened then in the intervening years? It all started in 1995 when Channel 4 aired an episode of Trial and Error, a programme focusing on miscarriages of justice. This programme featured George McPhee's conviction. The documentary highlighted a staggering 29 discrepancies in Colin Hawkins' testimony.
29 discrepancies?
Isn't that shocking? And a number of associates of McPhee also came forward alleging the police had attempted to coerce them into giving false statements implicating McPhee in Totsie's murder. Furthermore, the documentary presented evidence that McPhee did have a solid alibi on the day of the murder. He had claimed he was 60 miles north of Kolboki, deep in the Scottish Highlands, stealing snow poles with Colin Hawkins.
What are snow poles?
So, yeah, if you're wondering what they are basically, technically they're hazard delineators and they're used on UK highways. So basically when the snow is really deep, so in remote areas, and it's difficult to make out the sort of side of the road, the poles are every few feet along the road to tell you that that's the side of the road so that it keeps you on track.
And they're going to steal them, so people are going to go off the side of the road as well.
Well, yeah, probably, but they don't care about that.
No.
But they're made of aluminium, or they certainly were, and they were commonly stolen and then sold on for scrap. People would just cut them down with a hacksaw at the side of the road. They were usually required in quite remote locations, so mountainous roads, that kind of thing. So the likelihood of being spotted and caught by anybody was quite remote. So it was a really common crime, certainly back then.
And I suppose, like, Hawkins has kind of used half truth and half not then, if he said the reason he had blood on his knuckles was from that.
Yeah.
But he's also then saying it was McPhee who was the murderer as well.
Yeah. Which we'll come back to all of it. So on the day of the murder, McPhee said that he and Hawkins had cut down 79 snow poles. And of course, there's no definitive proof of this, but the documentary did find a highway worker whose job it is to patrol these remote roads on a daily basis, and he had reported the snow poles as missing on the 25th of September, the day after the murder. So he would have noticed them every day. He was patrolling those roads every day. He only noticed they were missing on the 25th of September.
So that fits.
It does. It's quite likely that they had been taken on the 24th.
Yeah.
Furthermore, McPhee sold an amount of aluminium equivalent in weight to 79 snow poles on the 25th of September, the day after the murder. So both of these facts point to McPhee's alibi being genuine. And before you ask, there wouldn't have been time to cut down 79 snow poles and then travel to and from Kolboki in the middle of the day, in the middle of cutting them down, to go and murder Totsi. So it would have taken at least 7 hours to cut down 79 snow poles. And that then doesn't take into account any calls of nature, any breaks from what would have essentially been backbreaking work. Wouldn't take into account travelling there and back.
Yeah, because that was what I was thinking. I was wondering how long this would take. So
yeah,
even if you wanted to kind of have a bit of doubt, he'd have had to have done a load of work all morning and then gone and then done a load of work in the afternoon and stuff. And it just wouldn't really fit, would it?
No. So we know that Totsi was murdered at around 1 p.m. We know that McPhee and Hawkins were spotted at that petrol station at 9:30 p.m. just outside Kolboki that night on their way back from cutting down the snow poles. So that's a gap of about 8.5 hours, during which they would have needed to travel 1.5 hours each way up to the Scottish Highlands and then spend at least 7 hours cutting down the snow poles. So there just wouldn't have been enough time to do all of that and murder Totsi. Or, like you say, there wouldn't have really been enough time for them to travel a couple of hours from County Durham up to the Scottish Highlands, do a bit of that work, then drive 1.5 hours to Kolboki, find this bungalow and this random woman, burgle the house, kill her, then drive all the way back up to the Scottish Highlands, carry on chopping down the snow poles and then drive home, or at least be at Kolboki service station at 9:30 at night. It just does not fit.
No, and I think if you're already cutting these down and you know that the next day you're going to be able to sell the aluminium on and make some money that way, would you randomly do a burglary in the middle of the day as well? Like, it just doesn't fit, no.
So obviously this is all based on the assumption that they were cutting down the snow poles on the 24th of September. But as I said, there is compelling evidence to support that was the case.
Yeah.
The Channel 4 documentary also alleged that a key piece of evidence that was presented at trial, namely the fact that McPhee had been involved in a fight in which he'd produced a knife just 5 days before Totsi's murder, was incorrect. McPhee had an alibi for the day in question and was more than 300 miles away. But this was disregarded by the jury because it just didn't fit the narrative they wanted to buy. So obviously that this was something the prosecution were bringing up in trial because he's got form just 5 days before the murder. This is a guy that had already cut someone with a knife. So is it that shocking that he then stabbed someone with a knife 5 days later?
Yeah, but he wasn't even there.
He wasn't even there, yeah.
God.
And finally, the documentary called into question the evidence of Trevor Proudfoot, the inmate McPhee had allegedly confessed to behind bars. There is evidence that he was offered a plea deal in exchange for signing a statement confirming the confession. And we know how rubbish these confessions are, don't we?
That's what I was thinking, like, the confessions where it's like, oh, we said this in the cells, it's never true. Why would you confess it to some random person you've never met in a prison cell?
Exactly. So Proudfoot was a convicted drug dealer and he'd allegedly been given a reduction in his sentence for making this statement and testifying in court. The documentary explains that McPhee withdrew his alibi in an act of cutthroat defence, a high-risk strategy whereby you essentially play to the narrative the jury is clearly accepting despite a lack of real evidence. So McPhee was with Hawkins on the day of the murder, cutting down snow poles in the Scottish Highlands. He didn't kill Totsi and neither did Hawkins, but McPhee has accepted at this point that the true version of events was not going to be accepted by the jury. So he almost knew at this point he was going to have to lie as a way of kind of getting out of this. And he was going to have to say that Hawkins is telling the truth, in so much as they were both parked up outside Totsi's house that day, but that it was actually Hawkins that had entered the house and killed her.
Oh,
so
wow.
Does that make sense?
It does. So he knows that he's not going to be able to tell the truth.
Yeah.
So rather than telling the truth, he'll just give an alternate version of the fake sort of jury, what the jury have been told, in the hope that the jury then are going to kind of go, well, either there's reasonable doubt or it must have been Hawkins then or something.
Exactly, yeah, because it was a high-risk strategy and it rests on the prosecution then being able to prove that it was McPhee and not Hawkins that had killed Totsi, which ultimately they did on very flimsy evidence, including the presence of footprints in the veg patch.
Yeah, because I straight away was like, oh, well, if it's going to be either of them, it'll be him because of the size.
Yeah, and that was a key piece of evidence. So when the jury were trying to weigh up, was this Hawkins, was this McPhee, that was a key piece of evidence. So they went obviously with McPhee. However, it would later come out that the size of the footprint had been disputed by an expert, and D.S. Lister had purposely disregarded this information as it did not fit with the desired outcome he was trying to achieve.
Fuck, no.
Yeah. I know. And I think he also wanted to protect his reputation as this star detective who could crack murders. So because he's got an actual expert saying, we cannot be sure that that footprint is from a size 9 or 10 boot. In theory, it could be from a 7 or 8 size foot boot. He told D.S. Lister that, but Lister's like, no, I want McPhee to go down for this, so I'm going to disregard what you've told me. So to cut a long story short, Hawkins withdrew his testimony in 1997, alleging that police officers had forced him to implicate McPhee. He claimed they had threatened to charge him with the crime if he did not sign a statement, which said that McPhee had been the one to enter the bungalow on that fateful day. And it took several more years of protracted legal red tape before McPhee was declared an innocent man in 2005 at the age of 50.
Christ, and you said it was 18 years that he'd been incarcerated.
Yeah.
That is so much of his life.
Isn't it awful? You know, that is the, like you say, he'd missed seeing his kids grow up. They were literally just toddlers when he was sentenced to prison. D.S. Lister had died long before it came to light that he'd concealed evidence, but his reputation was ruined, albeit posthumously. But McPhee bared no ill will, instead choosing to focus on the real victim in all of this, Totsi. He encouraged the police to reopen their investigation and to catch her killer, but they weren't bothered. They released a statement saying they would not be actively pursuing anyone else. So, in other words, to save face, they're basically saying that although McPhee's been shown to be an innocent man, we still believe that he's guilty.
God, that's horrible as well. So you've been proven as innocent, but you still got that kind of hanging over you.
Yeah. And it reminded me, actually, of the Jill Dando case. So we had, I can't remember what his name was, Barry George, wasn't it? So he was convicted of Jill's murder, sentenced to prison, served a number of years behind bars before being acquitted and released and declared an innocent man. And I remember the police at that time said, okay, fine, we kind of accept what the courts have said, but we don't believe anybody else was responsible for Jill's murder and we won't be pursuing any other lines of inquiry.
Yeah, because is he the one who didn't get any sort of compensation?
Yeah, that's it.
Because they were just like, well, we'll let you out, but we still think you did. It's just horrific.
So if McPhee and Hawkins didn't kill Totsi, then who did? Well, someone who knew where the knives were kept in the house, probably. It is likely Totsi was in the middle of the washing up when her attacker struck. Evidence pointed to this. Was she washing the knife which would go on to be used as a weapon against her? Did her attacker grab it out of her hands? Who knows? What we do know is that after the knife had been mostly cleaned of Totsi's blood, her attacker knew which drawer it belonged in.
That to me is quite a telling thing.
Isn't it? And there's more. It came to light during the trial that she was strangled to death and only stabbed in the chest and neck after she was dead. It is believed her assailant had picked her up and strangled her, almost hanging her with his bare hands. So he would have almost been, it's likely that he would have been facing her as he did this. So it was quite intimate. And there was also a massive element of overkill, which is also extremely common where there is a very personal relationship between victim and murderer.
Oh my God, absolutely. That's not just a random, I'm burglarising your house and then I find you.
Yeah, I'm, you know, you're burgling some, we can never say that, burgling someone's house. And then, you know, yeah, she interrupts them and they just kill her to shut her up. No, I don't think so. So Totsi was also killed in the bedroom she shared with Kenny and then subsequently dragged into her daughter's room. Her daughter was always the first person to arrive home each day. Did her killer know this and in some kind of twisted way want 9-year-old Jane to discover her mother's body?
So, sorry if you've covered this already, but you said that she was strangled to death. Was that in downstairs and then she was stabbed upstairs in her bedroom, or was she strangled in her bedroom?
We don't know that, but we know that she was attacked in the bedroom. I think what police actually thought happened was she heard a commotion upstairs in the bedroom. She was doing the washing up. She was washing the knife, had it in her hand, didn't really think about it and just walked upstairs to kind of see what the noise was. And some of her husband's business papers had been kind of strewn on the floor. So it could have been a burglar, or it could have been some other reason that the papers were strewn on the floor. I don't know. I don't really want to discuss it much more for legal reasons.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's one for us to take over to our Facebook page. But I think it's interesting, isn't it? You know, I'm convinced it wasn't McPhee. It definitely wasn't Hawkins. It was definitely somebody that knew Totsi. And there's some other really interesting elements to this. So, you know, was it somebody that knew her very well? Obviously I'm not mentioning names here. But I'm sure we can all, point the finger, couldn't we, a little bit?
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting because obviously the first person anybody would think of in a case like this is going to be the husband or the spouse. But like you said at the beginning, the police looked into him and he had an alibi. So I agree. Let's take this over to the Facebook page and see what people think.
So on that note of Facebook, we now have a Facebook group exclusively for Patreon supporters of our show. And we've clubbed together with the True Crime Enthusiast podcast and also the UK True Crime podcast. So it's the three podcasts, and anyone who's a Patreon of either show is invited to the exclusive Facebook group.
We're not going to make you sign up to support all three shows because that would
be... No, definitely not. Definitely not. And it's a really intimate and safe community, isn't it, in which to kind of hold these sorts of discussions.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's... somewhere you can kind of delve a bit deeper into some of the other cases when we do our Patreon specials as well. You can come and have a chat with us about some of those.
And we'll be sending details to all existing and new Patreon supporters of the show. And we will, of course, continue with our larger Facebook group, which is open to all listeners of Seeing Red. But the Patreon-only group is probably where we can just be a bit more honest, I guess. Not that we're not honest on the main one, but we can sort of reveal a lot more of ourselves, I suppose.
Oh, crikey. We have also introduced loads of exciting changes to our Patreon site. So we have new tiers, loads more bonus content, and we will be releasing a full bonus episode of the show on the last Friday of every month, starting this month.
There are also 10 existing bonus episodes over there, and we're going to launch quarterly competitions and Q&As, and we're also going to have some extra episodes where we interview former detectives and also victims of crime. And we've got a couple of really interesting interviews already lined up, haven't we?
We do. So whilst we are away for our week on our end of season break, do have a think about checking us out on Patreon at patreon.com/seeingredpodcast and supporting the show whilst bagging yourself a load of extra content and access to our exclusive Facebook group.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to check out our sponsors Noom and Stitch Fix.
And if you do, let us know how you get on.
And don't forget, you can find us also on Twitter and Instagram, or you can email us at info@seeingredpodcast.co.uk.
And don't forget, you can find us on YouTube as well. Anything else we need to tell these guys?
No, that's it. So we will be back on Wednesday, the 20th of May, with the opening of season 4, which is going to be an absolute belter. Bethan's been working on it with a special somebody.
We have. So look forward to that, and we will see you then.
Bye.
Bye.